Miami Light Project presents Glorious Cause, the rock and roll dance retelling of the Revolutionary War by Dana Hansen. It's one part rock concert, one part dance performance, one part history lesson, and several parts cutting and comedic social commentary. December 7th and 8th at the Lightbox at Goldman Warehouse. Tickets at 305-576-4350 or MiamiLightProject.com.
And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents Monday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Another week of Topical Currents, Bonnie.
Here we go. Today's kind of scary.
Well, today we visit with a leading proponent of hospital transparency. He's Dr. Marty McCary. He's a noted Johns Hopkins Hospital surgeon and professor at its School of Public Health. He's also the author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. Welcome to you, Dr. McCary.
Good to be with you, Joe and Bonnie.
Welcome.
It's fearful to think that 25% of hospital patients are harmed by medical errors. That can't be, can it?
Well, you know, we haven't talked about this problem for a long time. We've had a sort of closed-door culture about our own mistakes. And quite frankly, I was surprised when I saw the New England Journal of Medicine study that said we harm 1 in 4 patients from some kind of mistake. We've got to be open and honest about this problem if we're going to really tackle it. And let's face it, the Wild West of healthcare is expensive, it's harming our own citizens every day, and it's gotten totally out of control.
How and when did hospitals become these secretive corporations?
Well, Bonnie, I don't think there are any villains in this game. I think we've got good people working in a bad system. But we've got to look at our traditions and ask, how can we do better? You know, medical knowledge has exploded. I mean, we've got services now. I met a guy in the cafeteria at my hospital who specializes in a part of the eye I've never even heard of. I mean, that's how specialized we are. But we haven't been able to coordinate all of these services. And we've got this big, gnarly system that now ticks off the patients. The doctors are frustrated. And we've got to step back and say, look, we're harming as many patients as we're curing with our newest chemotherapy drug.
Is there sort of a sense of omerta when they see things go on that aren't right to just keep quiet about it?
Well, I've noticed when I was a medical student that somebody did an operation that should not have taken place. It was clear that it was unethical. And the other surgeons, when they heard about this, kind of put their head down and shook their head no. They were quiet about the problem. They were bothered by the problem. But it was a modeled behavior that I then took as a student as this is how we handle the wide variations in quality. You are disgusted by it, but we don't act on it.
Are you talking about Mrs. Banks?
I'm actually talking about a situation similar to Mrs. Banks, but Mrs. Banks was a tragic scenario, one that I was so frustrated over, I quit medical school. She had something, a metastatic or cancer that had spread all over her body. She didn't need anything done. She didn't want anything done. There was really nothing modern medicine could offer her. The doctors wanted to do surgery. They wanted a biopsy. It wasn't going to change anything. She just wanted to be at home. I tried to voice her concerns to the staff. I got slammed. They talked her into it. They overstated the benefits, understated the risks. She had a bad complication and spent 2 out of the last 3 months of her life in a painful situation in the hospital. I had had enough. I had felt like this profession doesn't always tell the truth. And I don't know if I want to be a part of it. And that's when I left.
So you left, and then what happened?
Well, I started a School of Public Health at Harvard, and I loved it. There were new research papers coming out saying, look, we kill as many patients as we're curing with our new developments in science and technology. This is a major epidemic. We've got to start talking about it. And these doctors, David Bates, Lucian Leap, they became the leaders in the field. And I later also met some surgeons that were role models. And I said, you know, I miss the bedside care. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to be a doctor, and I'm going to be a good doctor.
Tell us about that Dr. Lucian Leap of Harvard and his question at the outset of a keynote speech at the National Surgeons Conference and the implications of that. That was...
It's amazing. He was speaking to a group of surgeons, thousands, and asked, how many of you know of another doctor who should not be operating because he or she is too dangerous? And every single hand went up. These are respected surgical leaders around the country. Everybody knows of somebody. And yet we do a horrible job of reining in the wide variations in quality. Now, of course, if everybody knows of somebody, that person is treating thousands of people in their career.
Exactly.
It's a real problem.
You have Harvard Medical School ties. Tell us this business that you talk about in your book, this Dr. Hodad, which is a moniker for what's essentially a medical hack.
There are Dr. Hodads at a lot of hospitals. Ever since I left Harvard, I've heard the term Hodad used to describe a surgeon at several of the hospitals I rotated through as a trainee. Hodad stood for Hands of Death and Destruction.
And they would shouldn't be laughing.
We shouldn't be
laughing. It's not, I mean...
But every place had one of these guys. The residents would joke around about it. They would call this doctor Hodad in the conference on rounds when they met as a group of trainees and residents. And it was his name, except when he was present and around. And everybody knew that this gentleman was dangerous, shouldn't be operating. And they would try to sort of push him out of the operative field. So they kept him out of the way.
You cite new studies that indicate that nearly one in every five, this is amazing, medications, tests, and procedures is likely unnecessary. So, and also we were talking about the 60 Minutes segment last night, which ties right in with that. Will you talk about that, and what should we as patients do when we are told by a doctor we need something and the doctor is the authority?
Well, you know, patients have suspected this for a long time. Some find the medical profession to be a closed door, even an arrogant business, but they don't like being in the dark. Well, I once made a mistake and I told a patient right away, I'm sorry, we didn't mean to order this CAT scan on you, it was a mistake. And he said, thank you, in a way I've never gotten a token of appreciation. He appreciated the honesty. Patients are hungry for just simple honesty in healthcare. And the honest truth is the Institute of Medicine, our largest, most respected firm of research in the United States, says one third of all of our health expenditures may be for unnecessary care, $750 billion. I mean, this came out, I think, a few weeks before my book, Unaccountable, came out, and it created a big national conversation. 20 to 30, some say up to 35% of all the medications we prescribe, all the tests, all the procedures are unnecessary. You know, these are not my figures. And I want people to know doctors are ticked off about this problem. It's not just patients that are frustrated. Doctors hate bad quality more than anybody. They see it every day. It bothers them. According to leading studies from top medical journals, these are doctors. 20% of blood transfusions are unnecessary. That's from the Journal of Transfusion Medicine. 15% of hysterectomies, that's from the Archives of Surgery. 23% of heart defibrillators, that's from the Journal of the American Medical Association. These are our top journals saying that these things we do are unnecessary.
So it begs the question, so before we get to the 60 Minutes segment, who's making the doctors do these procedures and tests? Who's making them do that?
Well, we've got a system that... The free market of the current system just rewards more volume. It doesn't reward quality, it rewards quantity. And these doctors are under intense pressure sometimes, sometimes driven from themselves, sometimes driven from the culture, they like what they do, sometimes driven from their own hospital managers that beat down them to do more things. Doctors, surgeons, oftentimes we have procedure targets and we have to do so many procedures in a certain fiscal quarter or in a certain month. And if we don't do the procedures we're budgeted to do, we get these emails that are not very friendly sometimes that say you're behind your targets, you're behind your goals. And we step back and we say, why is 30% of healthcare unnecessary? Well, look at the mess that we've created with this massive volume incentivized system. We need a quality incentivized system. And now for the first time in history, we have good ways to measure hospital quality. We need to reward doctors on quality, not just quantity.
We're speaking with Dr. Marty McCary about his book, Unaccountable. He's from Johns Hopkins Hospital. Doctor, you specialize in the pancreas and pancreatic surgery. In the book, you describe how some people with terminal pancreatic cancer actually go on chemotherapy unnecessary, and the last few months of their life is spent in a very low-quality form of life.
You know,
how does that happen?
We've got, first of all, the two medications out there for pancreas cancer, the two types of chemotherapy, extend your life on average about a month to a month and a half. Now, do you want to spend the last 6 months, 8 months of your life getting this toxic poison to live on average a month or a month and a half longer? You know, some people live a lot longer, and if they want to go for it, I'm all in favor. But patients are classically understated the risks and overstated the benefits. And we've got one study showing that 80% of people who have cancer, when they die, have received radiation or chemotherapy up until the week before they died. Mm. I mean, at some point, someone's got to use some reason and say, you know, the patients are just not properly informed.
We're speaking with Dr. Marty McCary, a little tongue-tied I am, I'm sorry. He's a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital and a professor at its School of Public Health. He's written Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. His website is unaccountablebook.com. And it's today's topical currents. We need to take a short break. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM, and online at WLRN.org. We're funded by listeners like you and by Disability Rights Florida, providing protection and advocacy services to people with disabilities statewide for 35 years. Disability Rights Florida on the web at disabilityrightsflorida.org. You can celebrate 500 years of Spanish culture in Florida at the Hollywood Arts Park Experience, Spain, featuring flamenco superstar Antonio Carmona on December 16th at the Arts Park Amphitheater in downtown Hollywood. Details at gohollywoodfla.org.
Everyone's talking about Stomp. USA Today says Stomp finds beautiful noises in the strangest places. The Boston Globe says if you haven't seen Stomp, go. If you have seen it, take someone and share the pleasure. Thumping, bumping, banging, crashing, and dancing. One of the world's longest running productions, Stomp is back at the Arsht Center with all new surprises from December 4th to 9th. Information at arshtcenter.org.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Marty McCary. We're talking about his book, Unaccountable. So, Dr. McCary, how can a patient best pick a doctor? I know many people are kind of limited by their health plans, but how can you really find a top-notch doctor?
Well, there are many great websites now that are emerging, and they've got good information on a hospital and sometimes on a doctor, but the transparency really needs to be at the hospital level. And you can look up now a hospital's infection rate. Pretty soon, in the next few months, you'll be able to look up the readmission or bounce back rates. We're pushing to get C-section rates, complication rates, volumes, so you can just know, look, is this hospital treat one case of Lyme disease a year or 100? Do they have a stroke center with one person that walks in every month or 50? And those websites are Hospital Compare, that's a site run by Medicare, hospitalcompare.hhs.gov. There's a great one by Consumer Reports called consumerreportshealth.org. There's hospitalsafetyscore.org. And I like sites like ZocDoc that just have good basic patient satisfaction scores.
Are those sites on your website as well?
We don't have them linked yet, but Hospital Compares Patient Safety Score and ConsumerReportsHealth.org. Okay.
And these are all new?
They're all emerging in the last couple months, and they're great, and they're getting populated with better and better information each year.
You know, you said that the prestigious large hospitals have 4 to 5 times the complication rates of other hospitals. Why is that?
Yeah, even among good hospitals, there's wide variations in complications. I mean, I can think of a lot of reasons, but look at my own field, pancreas surgery. If you need the tail of your pancreas removed, a section of your pancreas, you can have it done through a big open incision, or you can have it done through a small keyhole laparoscopic incision. And whether or not you get one version or the other is the randomness of what the doctor just likes to do. Mm. Same for colon removal, same for hysterectomy. I mean, these are some of the most common procedures in the United States.
You mean there isn't one that's preferable, that's called for or required? They can just say they want to open you all the way up, or just do a keyhole opening and it's up to the doctor?
It's totally up to the doctor. Now, there's good research, 15 years old, that shows in a solid randomized trial one is superior to the other. This is New England Journal of Medicine article on colon removal, yet it is still the Wild West. Still only 30-40% of colons are removed through the minimally invasive technique.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to call in, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. And also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org.
So I've mentioned it twice. Let's talk about it. The piece that was on 60 Minutes last night.
Great
piece. That ties in with your book.
Great piece. So it was interesting. The Hospital Management Associates Corporation, third largest for-profit hospital group, they've got dozens of hospitals all over the country, had goals for their emergency room doctors to admit 20% of all the patients they see from the emergency room to the hospital. Now, some of these doctors are saying, look, only 14% needed to be admitted to the hospital. And the hospital would give them a hard time. They'd send them these emails. They would basically pressure them. And 100 doctors in the 60 Minutes investigation said they were pressured to admit patients that they didn't feel needed to be admitted. Doctors don't like this. They don't. I mean, look, we like to practice medicine in the art form that we appreciate it as. Doctors are getting crushed right now. They're getting crushed from the pressure from their own managers. They're getting crushed by malpractice fears, by insurance premiums going up, by Medicare payment declining, by overhead costs going up. I mean, the docs are getting crushed out there. We've got 46% of U.S. doctors burned out, according to the Mayo Clinic. A big national study came out 3.5 months ago, just about a month and a half before my book came out. Doctors are speaking up, and there's going to be a revolution. They're going to say, look, we're not going to work for a hospital corporation. We're going to go subscription model. Have you heard of these doctors? They're called concierge doctors.
Right.
You get paid $2,000 a year. They don't want to deal with your insurance company. You're paying completely out of pocket, and that's a revolt.
But some people can't afford that.
Unfortunately, it's going to turn into a two-tier, two-class system. But that's going to be the consequence of these corporations dominating doctors, breathing down their necks, telling them what they can and can't do, and putting pressure on them to do unnecessary things. I mean, we've got a real epidemic.
You point out the irony that America's medical service can be both spectacular and incompetent.
You know, if you think about what we do as doctors, we have the privilege hardly any other profession has. Patients will tell me secrets they won't even tell their own spouse within seconds of meeting me just because I'm the surgeon that walked in to see them in the emergency room. They'll trust me to put a knife to their skin. And yet this privilege is being eroded. The trust is being eroded because of this closed door culture. People want to see what's going on. They want to know the options. They want to be informed. They don't want to just have this blind trust sometimes. And we don't even have a good system to give people their own medical records. Have you ever tried to get your medical records after a procedure? I mean, some hospitals do it well. And other hospitals charge you $200 to $300. They have a third-party company manage it. They they give you, you have to go down to the basement and beg somebody. And I mean, they're your records.
Yeah, by law, don't they belong to you?
They are your records and you deserve a copy and everybody should have a copy of their records.
You know, you say that we, the patients, should be asking more questions, but isn't the whole culture and the whole mystique surrounding doctors, it's a culture we've learned to treat them as gods, that they know everything, that we shouldn't question them, that they're in charge.
Well, I appreciate that trust. And I've got patients that come in and say, Doc, whatever you recommend, I trust you. I appreciate that. But at the same time, when we've got 8 different ways to treat prostate cancer, they've got to be informed. Research shows that 30% of second opinions are different from first opinions. Patients need to know about the epidemic of medical mistakes, that 30% of healthcare may be unnecessary, and that second opinions vary widely from first opinions, that you need to take control of your own health, because I'm convinced, like I live in Washington, D.C., the politicians are not going to fix healthcare. The hospitals are not going to fix healthcare. It's going to be the patients that are empowered with good information. And that's why we need transparency of hospital performance so they can choose where to go. Look, 60% of people will decide which restaurant to go on based on ratings online, but yet you walk into your healthcare blind. I ask my patients, why'd you choose to come to this hospital? They'll say things like, because the parking is easy here.
But isn't it often the insurance company that chooses your doctors and hospitals?
Well, increasingly, they're just usurping power now where they're telling you you can only go to one of these few places. But the great thing about Medicare, almost every hospital takes Medicare. It's a free market. Hospitals want your business. They're putting ads up. They're trying to get you to walk into their doors. We still have a healthy free market in America in healthcare. And patients should know they've got a big power in their vote in deciding where to go for their care.
How would even basic universal health care affect this situation?
Well, there's so many different versions of it. The one I think that's the most popular is that it's basically Medicare for all, or people have talked about lowering the Medicare age so that when you've got the government paying the bill for you, so we still have a free market, it's still private, but instead of a private company providing your insurance, the government is the insurer, in the same way Medicare is the insurer. And that gives you the power to decide where to go and influence the market, but yet you have coverage. Now, healthcare is turning into catastrophic care. I mean, when you have health insurance, you're really not getting insurance anymore with these massive deductibles for your routine care. You're just getting catastrophic care. I mean, people tell me their deductibles are $1,000 a year. I mean, they're essentially paying for their own health care.
$5,000 a year in some cases.
It's amazing.
I have just a question about somebody that I know right now who has a PSA that's rising. I know this isn't your area, but he has been told he had his prostate removed and has been told that he needs radiation now because the prostate, the PSA number is on the rise. It still isn't even 1. It's on the other side of the decimal point. He has a radiologist saying, you definitely need radiology. He has his oncologist saying, I don't think you do need it. And his regular doctor saying, I don't think you need it, definitely advising against it. What does somebody do when everyone, as you say, a second opinion means a second opinion? It can be just that.
You'll talk to 3 different specialists that do the same thing. 2 different, you know, orthopedic spine and neurosurgery spine, plastic hand, orthopedic hand, different specialists that do the same thing, and you will get different opinions. And the only thing a patient can do is meet with all of them. You would not believe the number of people that just see one person for something major. I mean, a major operation. First time they're going to go on a medication for the rest of their life. Patients need to know, number one, 30% of healthcare may be unnecessary, according to the Institute of Medicine. These are not my numbers, according to the Institute of Medicine. And second opinions vary widely. Talk to different folks and see what sounds most reasonable.
Let's take a quick telephone call here. This is Joshua in Fort Lauderdale. Hi there.
Hi. My question is, I'm 32 years old. I'm considering going into medical school to be a doctor as a second career. I've completed all of my prerequisites. And all of the doctors that I've shadowed have discouraged me from going into medicine because of the fact that their ability to provide care has been compromised by the compensation structure and by the corporations. And I was wondering what the doctor's advice would be for those people looking to go into medical school. Does he think that the revolution in patient care and doctors being able to make decisions for their patients will occur within the next generation, or will it take much longer? And I'll take my answer off the air.
I think it's a great time to go into medicine, not because doctors are going to make good money. We're going to make less money down the road. And you know what? That's a reality. But the art of practicing medicine, the benefit of having a family member thank you for taking care of their loved one is invaluable. And it is a wonderful profession. And the nurses, the doctors out there on the front lines, there is no greater bond that you will ever have with a colleague than working together on a mission to save somebody's life or take care of them.
Need to take another break. We're speaking with Dr. Marty McCary. He's a noted Johns Hopkins Hospital surgeon and professor at School of Public Health, and he's the author of a new book, Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Thanks for being with us. Vizcaya Museum and Gardens Contemporary Arts Project presents The Light Club of Vizcaya, a women's picture, an evocative film with original posters by New York artist Josiah McElhenney. The Light Club of Vizcaya is on view through March 18th. Details at vizcaya.org. When school is not in session, children may engage in risky behaviors, and the Children's Services Council of Broward County funds programs for children that maximize out-of-school time. Details at cscbroward.org. The Children's Services Council of Broward County. Our focus is our children. And we're funded by listeners like you and by Auto Direct, committed to making car buying or leasing as fast and simple as possible, offering pickup and delivery of your new car or truck at your home or office. More details at theperfectpayment.com and 800-615-1067.
Hello, I'm Renee Montaigne of NPR News. WLRN counts on listener support to pay for the news. You can help by making a contribution when the WLRN Fund Drive begins this Wednesday morning at 7. There will be only 3 hours of fundraising for the day. After 10 a.m., the rest of the day will be fundraising free. So please help WLRN bring you more news with as little on-air fundraising as possible. Give Wednesday morning, and please give as generously as you can. Thank you.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Marty McCary. We resume our conversation concerning his book, Unaccountable. Doctor, tell the story of the world-famous Dr. Michael DeBakey, probably the most famous physician of the 20th century, and the business with the Shah of Iran.
Well, when the Shah fell ill,
like 78 or 79,
around that time, just before the U.S. hostages, things were tense over there. And we decided to send over a doctor and what we thought was our best doctor for what he needed. Now, this speaks to the dilemma. Everyone's looking for the best medical care, and they're doing all this research, and they think they found the right person or somebody's recommended to them. The State Department sent over Michael DeBakey. Now, Michael DeBakey was considered the greatest surgeon of our era. He went over and operated on the Shah. The Shah had a tragic complication. The French surgeons there tried to hint to DeBakey that he should have left it drained, let infections clear and prevent a problem, and DeBakey didn't want to have anything to do with it. He came back. Long story, the Shah died from a complication of the surgery. He had a pancreas-associated abscess, died, and it turns out DeBakey didn't really operate on that area. I did research on DeBakey, and he was an amazing man, wonderful surgeon, invented all kinds of operations related to the heart and blood system. It turns out that out of his 400 some publications, only one mentioned the spleen, which is the organ he was operating on, and he wasn't even the lead or prominent author on that paper. It wasn't his area. And dare I say that Middle East has never been the same since.
That's true. What's been the reaction of your colleagues to this? I mean, it's in effect, it's an expose. What has been, or it's informing the public, what's been the reaction of most of your colleagues?
Well, by and large, the doctors have been completely behind this book because the doctors are frustrated with their own managers. Those that make the decisions and call the shots have alienated many U.S. doctors. And that's why we're seeing 46% of doctors burned out in the Mayo Clinic national study. Here's a quote from the New York Times 3 days ago. This was on the front page. Doctors complain that both hospitals and their institutions have too much power in every aspect of the medical pipeline, dictating which tests and procedures to perform and how much to charge and which patients to admit. Doctors are getting angry that they no longer control the delivery of care. Some doctor I ran into at a conference told me recently, I feel like I'm the tenant and my management is the landlord. It's not a good situation. It's not a good environment. And that's what we heard about on 60 Minutes last night. That's what the New York Times is writing about. That's what the Mayo Clinic is reporting with the burnout stats on docs. Doctors no longer feel that they own the delivery of medical care and they are frustrated with it.
So let's talk about some solutions. What are they?
Nothing motivates a hospital to move and fix a problem faster than transparency. When something is in the public eye, managers will rush to talk to their frontline people and ask them, what do you need to do? What do we need to do to allow you to do your job better? And the docs and the nurses often say, look, we know how to make care safer and better at this hospital. We just haven't felt that anyone's been listening. We feel disempowered. And we saw this in New York State. We're seeing this now with public reporting programs where outcomes are out there on the web. The managers are coming to the doctors and they're saying, what do you need to do to make this statistic better because it's in the public domain? And we need more transparency. We need transparency to bridge the growing divide between hospital managers and their frontline providers. Some hospitals have already mastered this relationship and others have strained it.
Let's take another caller. This is Sally in Hollywood. Hello, Sally.
Hi there. How are you? I just have two quick comments. One, I wish I'd had the opportunity to work with this physician that you have today. I am a registered nurse and have and can agree with everything he says. But the second thing is just an addition to an earlier comment he made. I actually was looking for a hospital online for my niece who had to have foot surgery and was in a small community hospital. And I said, no, you need to go somewhere better. And I actually Googled the best hospital for foot surgery and came up with some of his websites, but also came up with, which I don't know if I can mention the hospital, but in New York City, which was close to her. So she was able to go, and she had, because they listed their outcomes and their infection rates and everything that you need to know before you go into a hospital. So it really was a good experience for her, but it was Google that helped me out. So I just want to give a hip hip hooray for Google.
That's exactly what we need. We need empowered patients to create demand for hospital transparency. That was the impetus for writing the book Unaccountable, and that's the impetus for this movement. I'm not the leader of this movement. Doctors around the country, doctors' associations, the heart surgeons group, the American College of Surgeons, they're frustrated with the quality disparities in America, just as I am. And I'm describing this movement in the book. And it's an exciting movement because we are seeing this new phenomena take place where people are getting the information they need to make good decisions.
We have an emailer, Dr. Rodriguez. He says, your guests failed to mention that the reason most people are getting chemo at the end of life is patient preference. You neglect to mention patient excessive demands and unrealistic expectations on the course of treatment.
That's a great point. It's an important factor in the overtreatment epidemic. You know, there are incentives that lure some doctors, not all. Most doctors are doing the honest to goodness best thing in their best judgment. Financial incentives lure some doctors. The patient preferences. I mean, we've created this expectation in society that more care is better. And patients come in demanding that they get certain drugs, medications, chemotherapies, treatments, and that's a serious problem. And it's no wonder. You got the pharmaceutical industry directly marketing to them. Of course, they're going to come in demanding these things they're reading about in Sports Illustrated.
You described the procedures at the Mayo Center as being exemplary. Why?
There's this ethic at the Mayo Clinic that the doctors are in charge, that doctors are running the hospital, that the board is made up of doctors. And when I visited the Mayo Clinic, I walked through the operating rooms with a friend of mine, and I noticed every few rooms there was a lounge with a nice couch and a computer and a workstation and a TV and free food. And I said, gosh, this is like a dream for a surgeon. You know, you've got these rooms all over. You can just unwind, call patients, get work done, deal with your office. And I said, it's almost as if surgeons designed this. And he said, we did. Wow. And there's this, you know, there was a rule recently. Kathleen Sebelius was putting a rule out. And the rule said that on every hospital board in the United States, a doctor has to be on, at least one doctor has to be on the board. The rule was lobbied by the American Hospital Association, and it was changed. No longer does one doctor have to serve on a hospital board.
So who's serving on these boards?
All non-doctors.
Just businessmen?
Businessmen, leaders, people in the community, folks from Wall Street. A lot of times the boards are made up by donors to the institution. So I think it's great we've got all this input on the board, and sometimes some really good business expertise, but to lobby to change a rule that Sebelius was going to put out to say we don't have to have it one doctor on a hospital board, that's a great American tragedy.
Let's take another call before our break. This is Eric in Miami. Hi.
Hey, hi.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to share, I agree with the topic. I wanted to share my experience in second opinions. I'm 36 years old, and I was set up for open heart surgery, or valve replacement. And it just didn't feel right. That doctor was a very professional doctor, but I didn't feel right with the way that the procedure was or the decision was taken. It was offered to me; it was my option. But I looked for a second opinion. The second doctor really gave me broader spectrum, man. He said, listen, your valve, you know, it's not going to recover, but if you change your diet, if you control your cholesterol, if you do a lot of things, we can extend the time for your surgery. You don't have to do it right away, and getting on a mechanical valve, you know, you will be on medication for the rest of your life. And I did that, and it really, the outcome was my symptoms are pretty much gone. Still with the valve, he told me, you're going to get surgery eventually. There's nothing that you need to do right away. Probably in 5 years, technology is going to be better and outcome is going to be much better for you. But I definitely recommend everybody for any procedure just to go ahead and get a second opinion, always. Mm.
That's a great point and a great example of how sometimes there's another perspective that you may not be hearing about. In one study, 40% of the other options were never given to patients in patient encounters. So it's great to question. It's great. You can politely question. I have patients that say, you know, I would like to have my surgery here, but I don't want to offend the other doctor. You know what? We're okay with it. We've got tough skin. We went through residency training. You're not offending anybody if you politely say, I'd like to get a second opinion. I tell my patients, go get a second opinion. If you don't feel comfortable getting a second opinion, that may say something.
Aren't there many doctors whose egos are shattered when you say you want to go get a second opinion?
Well, medicine is a referral business, just like real estate and law, and your reputation is everything. And for somebody to come to you and then you say, you know what, I'm going to talk to somebody else, it'd be like going to a real estate agent and saying, I'm going to talk to the person in the desk next to you and get another opinion. Medicine's got to be different. We've got to endorse that. We've got to welcome that. We've got to say there are many ways to do this. I tell my patients, if you feel comfortable with a second opinion, please get one. I want what's in your best interest. Don't feel obligated to have me do the surgery. And you know what? They love that honesty so much, I think that drives them to have the surgery with me.
We're speaking with Dr. Marty McCary. He's a noted Johns Hopkins Hospital surgeon and professor at its School of Public Health. And he's the author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. We have more of your calls and emails coming up, but we need to take a short break. Please stay with us.
Back to Topical Currents in just a moment here on South Florida's NPR News Station 91.3 WLRN and NPR for the Florida Keys 91.5 WKWM. We're funded by listeners like you and by ConservArt, specializing in restoration and custom framing for the care, conservation, and displaying of fine art. Insurance claims are a specialty. A complete list of services offered is at conserveart.net.
Florida Grand Opera presents Puccini's La Bohème at the Arched Center in Broward Center. The South Florida Classical Review said, Hélène Pérez sings with a warm lyricism that's perfect for the role, and Arturo Chacon Cruz gives a terrific performance of youthful ardor and vocal power. You can experience Puccini's capturing of love's passion and sorrow set in the Latin Quarter of Paris. More at fgo.org or 800-741-1010.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you, Joseph Cooper, and we're still talking with Dr. Marty McCary. Let's go to the phones. We've got Lynn. She's in Delray Beach, and thanks for your patience. She's been on a long time.
Thank you. I have two comments, both of which are germane to the things that Dr. McCary has talked about. I was scheduled for a gallbladder removal, and I discussed with my Boca surgeon the fact that the hospital to which he had privileges had a higher rate than normal to be expected with the population of infection. And I said I preferred to have my operation done in New York, and he agreed with me totally. Now, the state of Florida compiles these, and you can get these statistics. New York State compiled them at the time, but would not release them to patients. But I happen to know a particular hospital and its infection rate. The other thing was I had DCIS, and breast cancer, mild. And post-surgery, I was discussing with my surgeon treatment and care, and he said, well, I'm going to put you on tamoxifen. And I said, why? He said, well, I give it to all my patients. So my next meeting, I presented him with 20 pages of research I had done in which it said, because of my age, over 65, and certain other circumstances, tamoxifen was not the way to go. In fact, nothing, no chemo or radiology was the way to go. And I am now, I think it's been 8 years, and I am fine. And I think he was so affronted that a patient would question a treatment that he had done to all of his patients. It was as if the God had clay feet of clay. And those two, patients must be informed. And if you're going to be scheduled for an operation, explore the hospital, the infection rates. Delray Hospital, by the way, is wonderful in this. They're scrupulous, and my husband has been operated there twice, and they are scrupulous about preventing infection. Those are my comments.
Thank you.
Yeah, there are some great hospitals in this area. I spend a lot of time in this Miami, Boca, Delray corridor, and there are some terrific doctors, amazing hospitals. There are 200 national registries in healthcare, registries that monitor patient outcomes. They're all independent. Only three make their data available to the public. Now, that's a tragedy. Most of these national registries are taxpayer-supported, and yet only three make their data available to the public. We need more of this transparency so folks like this caller can do that research, find out where to go, and make good decisions. And congratulations, by the way, being 8 years out from DCIS breast cancer. That's terrific.
We have an emailer. This is David in Miami. A 2009 Harvard University study estimated that 45,000 people die in the U.S. each year due to lack of health insurance. Given the much higher numbers of deaths estimated to occur due to medical errors, which of the estimates is off? It seems counterintuitive to imply that it's less risky to receive no medical care than to receive medical care.
Well, many times those without insurance get worse medical care than those with insurance, even though they're still getting medical care. And this disparity is one of the great problems in American medicine. And that's a great point that's raised. You know, medical mistakes are hard to measure. And the Institute of Medicine report suggested that about 100,000 people die each year from medical mistakes. Well, that was over 10 years ago. Now people are saying, we know the rates haven't changed over time. That was a New England Journal study from last year in January. Maybe medical mistakes are the number three cause of death in the United States. If you just look at the numbers and you use the CDC estimates for heart disease, cancer, medical mistakes fits right in as number three. Now, we spend a lot of money on heart disease prevention. We spend a lot of money trying to cure cancer. We are just now acknowledging that medical mistakes ranks number three, let alone spending efforts and resources to really combat the problem.
Let's take another caller. This is Freddie. Freddie's in Miami. Hey, Freddie.
Good afternoon, Doc. Thank you. I appreciate you coming on the program. I appreciate WLRN. My father, I had a great task of becoming an expert as a pseudo caregiver in pancreatic cancer. And by what I mean by that, I had to find out what these drugs did. But prior to his surgery, a physician placed my father under a common drug called Neurontin, and he developed pancreatic cancer 2 years afterwards. That, regrettably, came to know way too late. But are physicians, I mean, do they know the harm of some of the products that they put the patient in? And my second question is, when the provider is Medicare, my father didn't have a choice as to his second opinion to his pancreatic surgery. You just stated previously that one could receive laparoscopic surgery, but that was never presented to my father. And let me tell you that surgery was the most dehumanizing experience that we all as a family went through. Nevertheless, he made it. He stayed with us for 9 months, in addition to experimental chemo, which, once again, as a private caregiver, was a dehumanizing experience at home for me. Thank you, Doc. I'll take your answer off the air.
I really appreciate Freddie's comments, and it's almost as if everybody in America has a story like Freddie. Somebody has a story of their mother or brother. I have two stories from my family, and it's almost as if everyone's got a story of some bad experience with the healthcare system. We've got a long way to go to restore the trust that medicine had with the general public. And I think transparency is what people are hungry for. And polypharmacy is a real problem. If I could say real quickly, we have older patients that are on so many medications, they're not coordinated. And you talk to any geriatrician or family medicine doctor, one of their primary goals is to reduce the number of overall medications in their patients.
I just want to end on a more positive note because we're almost to the end of the program. Do you think that younger, up-and-coming doctors are more willing to be transparent?
Well, that's the great thing, Bonnie, about our new students, our residents, the young doctors in practice. Look, they come from a generation that has very little tolerance for BS. I mean, they expect the truth and transparency in every aspect of life, not just in being a doctor. And we're seeing nurses speak up more frequently. We're seeing students call out their own residents. We're seeing standards by the deans of medical school where if you engage in disruptive behavior, you're going to be on the boss's couch trying to explain what happened. That's different. We didn't have that 10 years ago. Heck, 10 years ago, we didn't even have a checklist to go through before we did surgery. That's something that we developed all recently. So it's an exciting time in healthcare. All we need is transparency. With transparency, patients can feel empowered to know what they're getting and know where they're going for their care.
Well, thank you so much.
It's certainly been a very interesting hour. Once again, Dr. the website where people can learn more about you and the book.
Unaccountablebook.com, and the book should be available everywhere.
We certainly want to thank you. We've been speaking with Dr. Marty McCary of Johns Hopkins Hospital, and the book again is called Unaccountable: What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. Thank you very much, Doctor. It's really been an interesting hour.
Good to be with you, Joseph. Good to be with you, Bonnie.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page and find author and book links, such as today's, also staff photos and discussion. And of course, we have free audio archives and downloads of recent programs on our website, the new WLRN.org. And tomorrow's program is with sociobiologist Rebecca Costa, who addresses the question of why we can't seem to solve problems anymore. She's written The Watchman's Rattle, Thinking Our Way Out of Extinction. And to the calendar, on this day in 1857, 155 years ago, the birth of author Joseph Conrad in Poland. He didn't learn English until his 20s. Heart of Darkness, Lord Jim. And on this day in 1930, 82 years ago, the birth of singer Andy Williams in Wall Lake, Iowa. His popularity started on the old Steve Allen Show of the 1950s. Of course, he died September 25th with 18 gold records and 3 platinums. Canadian Sunset, Moon River, It's a Wonderful Christmas. And one more. On this day in 1947, 65 years ago, A Streetcar Named Desire by Tennessee Williams opens on Broadway, starring Marlon Brando and Jessica Tandy. Stella. And we leave with a line from Streetcar, uttered by Blanche DuBois. If you'll forgive me, he's common. He's like an animal. He has an animal's habits. There's something subhuman about him. Thousands of years have passed him right by, and there he is, Stanley Kowalski, survivor of the Stone Age. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the